We've got quite an agenda today, so we're going to try to move this along as quickly as possible. We have Senator Carlson's Senate File 99, and this is a child restraint bill. And we're going to hear that last, and I apologize to all the folks that are here to testify on Senator Carlson's bill. But we've got a couple bills that we're going to kick out real quick. So, Senator Saxog, you want to take the testifying table? Senator Vandeveer, get ready because you're up next. Senator Saxog, Senate File 335.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As you say, Senate File 335. I have an amendment I would like moved to get this in shape.
Senator Scoy moves the A1 amendment. We're going to hold off on the vote, Senator Saxog, but we're going to work off the A1 amendment. So explain the A1 amendment.
This amendment does two things, Mr. Chair. First, it changes the name of the Memorial Highway to Speaker Irvin N. Anderson. We put in a call for to Irv's widow, Phyllis, and she asked for this change, and that's why we're changing it with the amendment. Second, we're changing part of the designation to make sure that we don't overlap with the Voyager Highway, which is also a part of Highway 53. This bill, as amended, will name a portion of Highway 53. That's the highway that starts in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, ends up at the border at International Falls. But a portion of that highway from Virginia to International Falls will be named after Speaker Irv Anderson. There are probably very few people who have driven that stretch of highway as much as Irv did. He worked tirelessly on the condition of Highway 53. A few things about Irv that you may or may not know. He passed away in November, of course. He's a World War II Navy pilot. There used to be two World War II vets in the legislature. Now we have just a single veteran, that being Representative Bernie Leader.
Senator Saxog, let the record reflect that we do have a quorum, and Irv Anderson was a decorated war hero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I should have recognized that. He also served 17 terms as state representative. He served from 1964 to 1982, and then after being defeated a couple times, came storming back in 1990 and served from 1990 to 2006, was elected Speaker of the House in 1993. Some terms that I would describe him, and probably many people would also describe him as, are tenacious, strong-willed, determined, and, of course, cantankerous. And, you know, I think we'd all say nothing that Irv Anderson ever did was by accident. So if you ran into him and something happened, it probably wasn't by accident. Some of his biggest accomplishments, he's credited with bringing the House into the digital age. Under his direction, the public gained access to the House committee meetings and floor sessions, both on the Internet and TV. And he provided a laptop computer to every member on the House floor. Minnesota Miracle and Minnesota Care were created during his tenure. In 2000, he helped create the 21st Century Mineral Fund, which is important to those of us on the Iron Range. As a World War II veteran, he was very proud of his role in authorizing the World War II Memorial, which we now have on the Capitol Mall. I've provided an article if you want to read more about Irv, but I would be very happy to stand for questions.
Any questions for Senator Saxog? Senator Scoy moves that Senate File 33.
A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry.
A1 amendment?
On the A1 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Senator Saxog, as you know, on these memorial signs, we do expect a fundraising effort to pay for the signs.
And Mr. Chair, we expect no state money to be spent on these signs.
Exactly. You know, not only was Representative Anderson a colleague of most of the folks around this table, but he was a real friend to all of us. And I can remember having a couple of shouting matches with when he was Speaker, with Speaker Anderson. And as big and as loud as I can get, I didn't win. So I always respected him. He was a great guy.
And Mr. Chair, I was his junior senator for 4 years, so I understand exactly what you're talking about.
You know what I'm talking about, yeah. Then. Senator Scoy moves that Senate file 335 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Senate floor. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Senator Van De Veer. Senator Van De Veer, which Senate file are we working off of now on yours?
152.
152. Okay, Senator Van De Veer, Senate file 152.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members, this, the bill simply prevents the establishment or introduction of any new toll roads in Minnesota. It keeps the I-394 corridor in place, but would prevent any new ones. That's essentially the purpose of the bill. It's
Senator Van De Veer, what does this? What would this do to our?
I don't have the.
Yes, our UPA agreement on Highway 35.
It would probably stop it, hopefully. Oh.
Well, that's a pretty good description. Senator Van De Veer, you know that there's a lot of federal funds tied up in that project, and the use of congestion pricing, in, you know, I'm with you on the toll roads. Toll roads are – Minnesota doesn't have a toll road mentality, and I don't think we're ever going to get there. But the one thing that we do is, like on 394, is we have congestion pricing. That works, and we've been to workshops all across the United States, as a matter of fact, all across the globe, and there's been all kinds of people that have come and looked at the 35, the 395 or 394 project, as well as the project on Highway 5 in San Diego. These work, and that helps to reduce congestion. So,
Mr. Chair,
Senator Van De Veer,
making it harder and more expensive for people to get to work on a road would decrease congestion and the usage of it. Charging them more to use it when they have to get there. I think if that was the goal in and of itself, there's other ways to do it. A recession does it. Things like that, but I'm not. What you're doing with congestion pricing is just making that road cost more, and either they use an alternative route or they pay to go on that lane. But what happens is these will continue to expand, and the only lanes that'll work, because we're not expanding the other lanes, are the toll lanes, and so people will be forced inevitably to use tolls, and that's what we're establishing. And I do believe Representative Anderson in the House last year, I was there, supported this amendment on the floor.
Well, I said he was a friend. I didn't always say he was right.
So, he was right a lot, Mr. Chair. I'm opposed to the toll roads and to the expansion of it, and I do believe that this is more than a slippery slope. It almost ensures that we will have more and more tolls, and that in order to get new lanes, we'll end up tolling the lane next to the congestion pricing lane. And, yeah, congestion pricing works, but what you're doing is you're just limiting the people that can afford to use that lane.
Well, actually what we found out, Senator Van De Veer, was that someplace between 30% and 40% of the driving population that are out there during high-volume hours didn't need to be there. They were going to Target or Walmart or wherever, and they really didn't need to be on the road. What it did was it moved those trips from, 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning and moved them to 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock when there's less volume out there. So you immediately got rid of quite a bit of the traffic. Those who chose to pay, they paid. In times when it was really congested, they'd have to pay more. In less congestion, they paid less, but they still paid. Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Van De Veer, over the years, with regards to the bridge at in Stillwater, the new bridge, with estimates now approaching $500 million. I've had, or I've heard proposals of making that bridge possibly a toll road, establishing a road authority, and just for the bridge itself. So what are your thoughts on something like that?
Well, I think Senator Murphy mentioned on the floor when I had this amendment up that Wisconsin won't participate in a toll bridge from Wisconsin. So
yeah.
I think that would probably be problematic. I had that on the amendment because it's what put it over the top in the House when I left. So I left it on the amendment. But if that's the case, we probably wouldn't want to do that.
Thank you.
Well, I'm certain we wouldn't want to do it because we would need their contribution on the other side of the river.
Senator Olson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the I-394 Minpass Lane, I think, does, in fact, work. And I appreciated the help of the entire Senate in putting a little pressure to not have it be 24/7, because it was a stretch of highway that that had been, the Seine lane was restricted for certain hours of the day, rush hour, and then it was open the rest of that time. And so people for 12 years had been used to that. And so I think we ended up getting the attention of MnDOT and negotiated that to put an extra hour one direction, an extra 2 hours that are part of the MnPass toll for the other direction. And it is carrying a very high capacity, but you don't have to pay to drive on it if you have a passenger, and it handles all of the transit as well. And so it's got very high volume on it. Now, some people think, I've heard from some people that think that it's underutilized, and it would relieve if we opened it up, and so therefore it should, that what you're paying for on there is to be able to maintain a speed that allows for a continuous flow. And so there are other options. I'm too tight to pay tolls either, so I either have a passenger when I ride it, but if I can't and I've got to go during rush hour, I have learned what times to go when you have less congestion. So you do manage your behavior in terms of being able to get through the congested parts by your timing or, as you say, alternate routes. There are other ways, and it has increased the capacity of that highway.
Well,
and I think that it's been recognized as a success. On the face of it, one would think that it wouldn't, and I'd be the first to say that if I felt that it was just charging people to make some money, that I wouldn't be supportive of it. But I think that concept has worked, and I hope that it will work on 35W, and I would hate to see that stopped.
Senator Vandiver.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, we don't doubt it worked, but if we look at the history, it was a Seine lane is what it was called, and nobody was on it. So it was kind of an insane lane to have sitting there during rush hour, and the only way we could use that was to toll it. I think the federal government wouldn't allow us to because they had participated in building that highway. But secondly, it cost the first 2 years that lane was there, it cost more in tolls to collect the tolls than they got from it. Now MnDOT says it costs about $1.1 million to collect $1.3 million. I just think that people in Minnesota are paying for the roads. They are paying more since last year for roads. And I don't think we're a culture that likes toll roads, and we don't have them, and I think we should just stop it right here.
Senator Vandiver, Senator Salzman has a question, and then you've got a couple testifiers. Is there anybody?
There might be some opposition.
Oh, I think there's plenty of that. Senator Salzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Vandiver, we, I think, share the current Stillwater Lift Bridge. And so I'm very pleased that project is being accelerated because of a bill that this body passed in February to accelerate that bridge. And I would certainly have loved your support of that bill. That will really target dollars, but
the $650 million in new taxes, is that the bill?
Excuse me,
Was it the $650 million in new taxes during a recession, that bill?
It was the gas tax. It was the investment in our roads and bridges. So what I'd like to just go with this is that, you know, we are really at a time when we have really limited resources. And as we talk about how we're going to address the situation, I like to make sure we have as many tools as possible. And that's not to say that I'm supporting a toll facility or toll roads at this point in time, but to pass a bill that would really tie our hands. And we're also hearing a lot about public-private partnerships, and I don't think that we're as educated as we might be about some of those. That's not to say that we sell off our infrastructure, but I'm really concerned about, you know, taking things off the table at a time when we really should be looking at where there are opportunities. And, you know, a toll facility might have a broader meaning in that. So I hesitate to really support this. I just think we need to make sure that we have as many tools on the table as possible in making sure that our infrastructure is strong and that we can move, you know, our people around the state.
Senator Vandeveer, you don't have anybody here to testify in support?
No.
Is there anybody here that wants to testify in support of the bill? Is there anybody here that wants to testify in opposition to the bill? Senator Vandeveer, I think you had a response for Senator Saltzman. I didn't mean to cut in, but go ahead.
I think we can. The point of you know, not doing it now, that point has been made for the last 8 years, and I think at some juncture, if you don't like toll roads, you would vote to eliminate them, and if you do like them, you would vote to keep them. So I think at some point we have to vote on it.
Is it Mr. Thompson?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Mr. Nick Thompson from Minnesota Department of Transportation and the UPA program coordinator. Here to testify in opposition of this bill. Minnesota's had a successful, as you've heard, congestion pricing system since 2005. We call that the MinPass system, where we took the existing HOV facility and opened it up to additional users who are not allowed to use it under its restrictions then. We have over 12,000 Minnesotans signed up for the 394 MinPass system, and that will grow quite a bit when we add that system to 35W later this year. We are carrying more vehicles in that HOV lane on 394 than we were before the MinPass system, and we expect that to occur on 35W. We've also seen other benefits that weren't mentioned yet. We've seen a reduction in crashes on 394, a reduction in corridor congestion for all users of that corridor, and those are some of the side benefits that a system like the congestion pricing system benefits. In 2007, Minnesota received $133 million in federal funds under the Urban Partnership Agreement. And the legislature last year gave us authority to act on those funds and provided matching funds for that. With those federal funds came an agreement that we reached with the U.S. DOT. It is building several projects on Highway 77, Minneapolis, 35W, both to the north and south of Minneapolis. Within that agreement is our commitment to implement the MinPass system on 35W, and most of those federal funds are under contract now through over 20 different projects under UPA. So we've started to spend some of those federal funds, and most of them are locked up and will be spent this year. We expect one of the projects, the MinPass system, to open on September 30th of 2009 on 35W in the first stage of it, and the second piece within the Crosstown project to open in 2010. If this bill were to pass as is, we're not sure what would happen with the U.S. DOT. Three other cities that received UPA grants did not get the legislative authority they needed, and their federal funds were withdrawn from those communities. And we would be in violation of the term sheet we did sign with the U.S. DOT for UPA if this bill passed as it was. We believe the MinPass and the congestion pricing system is a very effective tool that gives more people choices to avoid congestion when they need it. It utilizes existing capacity of our road better and keeps traffic moving. And with that, we would be opposed to this bill.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Thompson? Senator Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mrs. Thompson, I'm sorry I wasn't here for Senator Vannevar's presentation of the bill, but if his bill passes, will that have an impact on the projects that you've been talking about?
Mr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yeah, we believe it would. It would. One of the key parts of our UPA is to develop the MinPass congestion pricing on 35W, and this bill would prevent us from doing that and put us in violation of our agreement with the USDOT for those federal funds. We don't know exactly what the USDOT would do, but we would definitely be in violation of that agreement.
But it looks like they have a track history of taking the money away.
So yeah, Mr. Chair, they do. On three cities, they have taken it away.
Right. 5 minutes. So I don't know if I dare or not, but Senator Day.
Mr. Chairman, and this is nothing, well, it's a little bit about the testimony. For 12 straight years, I had a bill on the SANE lanes. We all knew they were bad. It was like 43% of the people in the SANE lane were there illegally. The other half of the people that drove in it had their mother or their son or daughter or significant other there. So it's always been bad. So it took us 12 years, and it's kind of fun because for 12 years they wouldn't do anything with it. And now all of a sudden they're here testifying that we got a wonderful system, which I think we do. And it's I guess what goes around comes around, but it's just amazing that I'm sitting here now listening. We're finally opening up the SANE lanes and doing something that's right, and somebody is testifying for them. Because they always came here and said, we can't do that. We gotta force people into their cars. We're going to give them garages in downtown Minneapolis at reduced rates, and we're going to get all these people, and they're going to get out of that one-person car, and never happens.
Well, that's true.
You so know, anyway, it's just, it's good. Nothing to do with Senator Vannevar's toll road stuff. This is just a...
Mr. Chair,
editorial.
Mr. Chair,
a slight Chair. Editorial cinema.
Right.
Mr. Chair, I think for the last 12 years, no one's ever said thank you to Senator Day. So, thank you. Do we have closure now?
A round of kumbaya would work. Mr. Esteson, I believe that you wanted to give us a Chamber of Commerce's perspective. If we could keep it short, I know we're having kind of a good time here, but we're limited, so we need to move along.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Jeremy Estenson, Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Very briefly, our position remains the same as it was last year, which is we oppose tolling on existing lanes, save the 394 MinPass system. The reason for our opposition is because we simply don't want to limit MnDOT's congestion management tools on future lanes.
Fair enough. Senator Vannevar, final words.
Thank you for having the hearing, Mr. Chair, and airing this issue, and I appreciate it, members. Mm-hmm. And that would be all I'd have to say.
All right. Do we have a motion? Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yeah, I'm going to move Senator Vannevar's bill, not because I want to have anything to do with this congestion management, but basically, I agree with him about toll roads. If we go toward toll road as funding roads, folks that don't have much traffic won't have roads. And so I'll move Senator Vannevar's bill, Senate File 152.
Senator Scoy has moved Senate File 152 to be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to vote against Senator Vannevar's bill. I've voted for his amendments in the past, but I have since that time learned a lot and moved a long ways. And you know, there might be some variation on his bill with some caveats, some recognition. You know, in those places where people don't have options, in those places where you know we don't have innovations and the like, but. For all the reasons that Senator Olson so ably articulated, I think a blanket prohibition on tolls is not the wave of the future, is not the way to go. I think we've got the UPA that shows that we need some innovations, we need some more tools. Senator Salzman was very articulate. So, you know, maybe Senator Vannevar, if your bill does not prevail, we can work together on some other ideas.
We could work on it on the way to finance.
Senator Bonhoff.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I too am going to vote against this bill, Senator Vanderveer, although I appreciate you bringing it forward. And I've been concerned about some of the trends I've seen around the country with regard to innovation in finding revenue. For example, you know, Indiana's selling their toll road or leasing their toll road. Some of those things really concern me, and I think fly in the face of the values that we hold here in Minnesota. You know, blanketly, I prefer not driving on a toll road, but I can tell you that that, you know, 394 lane, that MIN pass, is a lifesaver. And I applaud Senator Olson for being patient enough not to use it, but I couldn't get by without it once having gotten used to what that does to get around the tunnel. And so I think the people who live along that 35W area where they're going to get that benefit, they are going to be so grateful for this innovation, and they are really going to appreciate that we supported the UPA, and thanks to Senator Rest for all her efforts to make that happen, and to Chair Murphy for making that happen.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to vote against Senator Vanderveer's bill because I authored the MIN pass legislation, and I authored the UPA legislation. And I think that they are innovative ways of dealing with congestion, and that is the goal. The goal is not imposing tolls on anybody. The goal is how do we improve the travel time that it takes Minnesotans to get around the metropolitan area. And I think your bill would jeopardize all of those opportunities and that are coming to fruition now, and particularly getting support from the federal government.
Hi. Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Vanderveer, I, too, am going to vote against your bill, but for slightly different reasons. I'm always opposed to toll lanes when there's no alternative. And with the UPA agreement, I believe that there's been a lot of work done to give that alternative. You can drive parallel to someone who is in the toll lane, or, as Senator Olson said, you can have more people in the car. So, in my view, it gives the alternative for someone who doesn't have the means to be able to drive in that lane and pass everyone up just because they happen to have that means. So, in my case, those accommodations are what is important to me. We don't need to have a wealthy class that can just drive by everyone else. So, I think that we need to have that flexibility and that tool to be able to manage congestion, manage funding, and do all of the things that we need to do.
So thank you. I think the committee is ready to vote here. All in favor of the SCOE motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion does not prevail. Thank you, Senator Vanderveer. And Senator Vanderveer, you might just so you know, you should probably look up Chapter 160.845 and look at Clause A. There's a provision in there that does preclude the state of Minnesota to convert toll roads or convert public roads to toll roads. So there are some instances that, you know, you just can't do it willy-nilly. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Dole. Oh, you only had one.
Okay.
Can you go run them down quick? Thank you. In the meantime, members, we're going to be hearing Senate File 99, which is a child passenger restraint bill of Senator Carlson's. Senator Carlson, maybe you would want to kind of walk us through what the bill says real quick while we're waiting for Senator Dahl. You can do it from your seat there if you want.
Mr. Chairman? Mr. Chairman, are we doing 208 or not?
No, Senator Vanderbilt pulled Senate File 208. Okay. We did Senate File 335, mm-hmm. and we're done with 152 now. So, Senator Carlson, maybe you want to just tell us what is there anything different from the bill from last year?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and committee members, I don't believe there are any differences, true differences, in the bill from before. This is the child safety restraint bill. It's actually a misnomer to call it the booster seat bill. So I don't call it the booster seat bill. It is a child restraint bill, and it allows the use of an appropriate restraint and mandates that restraint between the ages of 4 and 8. And what it does is it allows people to determine what is the appropriate restraint for a child that is their responsibility. And you look at the tag on that seat and determine whether it's appropriate. And then it also mandates a fine that is not to exceed $50. And that goes into education, publicity, and providing low-income people the ability to get these booster seats.
Senator Carlson, I bought two this weekend, one for my son's pickup truck and one for my car.
Good for you.
And I spent $60. I mean, it's not going to break anybody's bank. Senator Dahl, thanks for coming today. And you have Senate File 47, and this is the restrictions on the Dan Patch commuter rail line. And first, I want to apologize to Senator Dibble. This bill should have been referred to Senator Dibble's subcommittee, and that was my mistake. But we're going to hear it right now, and hopefully Senator Dibble's toes heal up, because I think I just stepped all over them. But anyway.
We would have passed it up to you with flying colors, I'm sure.
So okay.
We'll consider that the committee report.
All right. Senator Dahl.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you, and it's a pleasure to be before you today. This bill, Senate File 47, is basically a repealer, and I can give you a brief summary of what it's repealing. This bill came before your committee last session. Passed with flying colors, passed the Senate, had some debate on the floor of the Senate, passed easily. What we're doing here in Senate File 47 is repealing a law passed in 2002, Chapter 393, Section 85, which basically eliminates any discussion of a possible Dan Patch commuter light rail line. If you're not familiar with the Dan Patch Corridor, it runs from Northfield and Rice County to Lakeville to Burnsville to Savage to Bloomington, Edina, St. Louis Park, and Minneapolis. And what the 2002 law did, and I'll just repeat some of the language here, the Metropolitan Council must not take any action or spend any money for study, planning, preliminary engineering, final design, or construction of the Dan Patch commuter line. The council must remove all references, other than references for historical purposes, to the Dan Patch commuter rail line from any future revisions to the council's transportation development guide and the council's regional transit master plan. The Commissioner of Transportation must not expend any money for study, planning, preliminary engineering, final design, or construction for the Dan Patch, and the Commissioner must remove all references other than references for historical purposes to the Dan Patch commuter rail line from any future revisions for the state transportation plan and the Commissioner's commuter rail system plan. No regional rail authority may expend any money for study, planning, preliminary engineering, final design, or construction for the Dan Patch commuter rail line. Now, I think in my discussions with people of not only Northfield but around the district and Senator Roebling's district, who's a co-author of this particular bill, that this is just not sound public policy. I think most would agree that this is just bad policy and bad politics. This is legislating by omission. And we're not going to build the Dan Patch tomorrow. We are just wanting to have a discussion. And maybe the Dan Patch line goes from Northfield to Lakeville to Burnsville and then to St. Paul. We don't know, but the fact that the good citizens of Northfield and other members along the rail who are generally interested in the kinds of possible economic development, energy savings, access to the cities, and vice versa, We just think it's the right thing to do. So while I wasn't around in 2002, I wish I would have been. I sound like a good time, but I think that
it wasn't.
I think we could all agree that having a piece of legislation that's in place that basically eliminates the planning, study, or discussion for MnDOT for the Met Council is just not good public policy. So I hope you'll consider this repealer. I do have, I think the mayor of Savage, is she here or not? If she want to just say a word or two, I would.
Ms. Williams, please come to the table. We have a lot of things to talk about down there in your neck of the woods.
We do.
Oh, a lot of road projects, not just the Dan Patch.
Thank you, Mr.
But
Chairman.
But we'll stick to the Dan Patch today.
Okay.
So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I am Janet Williams, the mayor of Savage. And I'm here to ask that you remove the legislation prohibiting the study of the Dan Patch Rail. Here's my story. I'm a lifelong resident of Savage who lived next to this railroad my whole life. And on a sunny fall day in 2001, my doorbell rang and two men from Hennepin County were at my door asking me to sign a piece of paper opposing this commuter rail called the Dan Patch Line. And when I said I thought it was a good idea, they left and that was the end of the conversation. But little did I realize the ramifications of this chance encounter, because the group went on to successfully pass legislation to prevent further study of the Dan Patch Line. What did it say? That study said that 14 trains would carry 7,500 passengers every day, and that it was the existing right-of-way was there, but the study should be relooked at it. After the North Star and the Red Rock projects had been completed. And so what's changed? Well, the problem is that we can't talk about it. And that as we look at our 2030 transit plan, we really think that this past decision to restrict the study might have been good politics at the time, but it was poor public policy, as Senator Dahl said. Every transit and transportation option should be on the table for consideration as a means to reduce our dependence on oil. And the restrictions placed on the study of the Dan Patch Line are hurting our efforts that would allow for the exploration of the possibility of the light rail either up 169 to St. Paul and or whatever. But it would help us to possibly connect with the Southwest Line in Eden Prairie. The supporters have been, and we passed around a brochure on the Scott County Association of Leadership and Effectiveness. And supporters are Scott County, the cities of Savage, Prior Lake, Northfield, the MBTA. And what do we need? We're not asking for any money. We're only asking that you lift the gag order and allow democracy to work. Permission to allow study and discussion to occur. The ability to evaluate all transportation options so that open and effective long-term planning can occur. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Any questions for the mayor? Senator Olson.
Yes, I've heard it twice now. I guess when I hear the word commuter rail, I think of something different than light rail. And both of you have referred to light rail, and I don't, unless the there's a definition of commuter rail that encompasses light rail. This law that was the prohibition was only against commuter rail, which is using
existing rail.
So
yes.
is it light rail or is it commuter rail? Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Michael Leake. I'm the Community Development Director in Shakopee. I've been there since 1996. I'd like to point out it's significant that I'm here because the Dan Patch Corridor is not something that's going to serve Shakopee 169. Is certainly more important for us in Shakopee than is 35W. But one thing you need to know about us is not only do we have scale, but for the last several years we've had both a staff and an elected official group, the Transit Planning Team, which I've chaired since its inception, and the Transit Review Board, that developed a unified transit management plan for all of Scott County. And those two groups support efforts to talk about, to study, and to plan for all transit alternatives. The practical impact of this restriction has been for the last several years that not only can we talk about commuter rail, which is what's specifically talked about in the legislation, but we can talk with our partners, the Met Council and with MnDOT, about other alternatives. We'd like to look at whether or not commuter rail in the Dan Patch corridor is a feasible alternative. If it's not, maybe it's some form of light rail, maybe it's some sort of bus rapid transit. But right now, those agencies aren't able to partner with us in a study that includes those alternatives, largely because of this legislation.
Any questions from the committee? Thank you, Mr. Leek. Well, Senator Dahl would move that Senate File 47 be recommended to pass, and this is John Dahl, placed on general orders.
Mr. Chair, I might want to back off from that motion simply because I want to get, I know the public policy part of that certainly makes sense that we should be able to talk about it, but I do know my cities and my district have opposed opening this back up. So,
I didn't mean to speak for you then.
Thank
sorry.
You.
Chairman, I'll make the motion.
Senator Ress makes a motion to refer Senate File 47 to general orders with the recommendation that it pass. Further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion does prevail. Thank you very much, Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee.
Thank you.
And my apologies, Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
This sounds like a bad movie. With that, we're going to move to Senate File 99, and this is Senator Carlson and the Child Restraint System.
Yep.
Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you very much for hearing my bill. This is Senate File 99, commonly called the Child Safety Restraint Bill. And what this does is we discussed previously a few minutes ago, this provides information for young parents who have children so that they know what needs to be done for children in their cars. This is the kind of progression that we can say came from the time that we didn't wear seat belts, and then we didn't wear shoulder straps, we didn't put kids in booster seats, we used to have them face forward, then we had them face backwards where there are airbags. Now we put them in the back, in the child booster seats, and now we have the children that are between ages 4 and 8, where we don't have the definition in law that advises parents how to deal with them. I'd like you to pay very particular attention to the statistics that you're going to hear and the costs, the personal costs and the money costs that you're going to hear, and we need to make our decision as to whether this is important for our young people. When we invest in our young people, and they get taken away from us while they're still young, this is a terrible tragedy. And in this case, we do have the statistics. We do know what these seats cost. We do know what kinds of differences it makes in the lives of children. What I have here is we have a couple of testifiers, and I'm going to introduce Ms. Gail Weinholzer, who is the Director of Public Policy for AAA. And Mr. Chair and members, I'm going to turn the rest of the program over here until the testifiers are done to Ms. Weinholzer.
Ms. Weinholzer, welcome to the committee again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Gail Weinholzer. I am the Director of Public Affairs for AAA Minnesota, Iowa, and I'm here representing our 700,000 AAA members across the state of Minnesota. I've been before you before with this legislation. It typically passes this committee. The last time we passed the Senate floor, 49-17, and unfortunately our friends in the House did not provide us the hearing that we needed, so we are back again this year. And I hope I can count on your support as you have provided it in the past. Before I begin, I want to share just a few materials with you that have been provided in your packets. The first is a brochure that was put together by part of our coalition, the Safe Kids Coalition, and it has a lot of the relevant statistics and facts surrounding this issue. The second is a guest editorial that was written by AAA. It's about a constituent of Senator Langseth, Bryn Duncan, and her family is here today to testify. The third is the state map of the United States. As you see, Minnesota is one of six states that does not adequately protect children during this age group from 4 to 7 with legislation. So we, when I testified before you 2 years ago, we were one of 12. Now we're one of six. And it shows the fourth piece is the guest editorial, or I should say the op-ed piece that was written by the Star Tribune editorial board this past Saturday in support of our legislation. I encourage you to review it all during the appropriate time. As I said, AAA is leading a broad-based coalition of organizations in support of Senate File 99. Some of these organizations are here today to testify. Others will talk about health care and law enforcement, but I wanted to speak on behalf of our 700,000 members who repeatedly have overwhelmingly supported this legislation by over 78%. And as you can imagine, it's pretty hard to get 78% of 700,000 people to agree on anything, but they do in support of this legislation. Child passenger safety is a top priority for us in Minnesota, which, as I mentioned, has one of the weakest laws in the nation. We're one of six states that does not protect the age group from 4 to 7. Our current restraint law was developed 26 years ago. There are members of my staff that were born since this law was passed, and that tells you how out of date and weak this legislation currently is. All we are asking you today is to modernize and update Minnesota's current statute to the level of best practice and not leave it out of date and too weak to serve as any useful purpose. As you all know, our nation's transportation system and vehicles were developed years ago and not with children in mind. Seatbelts were designed to restrain adults, thus putting children at greater risk of injury and death. Given that we are now a more mobile society and children are traveling more than ever, whether it be to soccer games or t-ball or whatever the situation may be, it's a challenge for us to modernize our transportation and vehicles to ensure children's safety. Automobile crashes remain the number one killer of children. In Minnesota, our current statute says that children under the age of 4 must be an approved child restraint system, and that children between the ages of 4 and 10 need to be restrained but with an adult seatbelt. Current legislation can give parents the false impression that after age 3, children are safe if they are only restrained in an adult seatbelt. Nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, research done by the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia about 5 years ago, and they did a study over multiple years, indicates that the appropriate child restraint used for this 4 to 7 age group reduces serious injuries by 59%. As AAA and others, including the Safety Council and Safe Kids and the Department of Public Safety, provide child passenger safety clinics and brochures and information around the state, the first question we are always asked by parents is, what does the law say? What do I have to do to be compliant with the law? Since parents are looking to the law for guidance, we must provide them with information that represents best practice and not the standard of 26 years ago. At AAA Minnesota, Iowa, we support a change to the Minnesota's current state statute by requiring children between the ages of 4 and 8, or under the age of 8, or shorter than 4 feet 9 inches tall to be properly secured in the appropriate child restraint system chosen by their parents. AAA Minnesota, Iowa believes in educating the public about the proper use of safety seats and restraints for all children. At AAA, we educate parents by conducting child passenger safety clinics, providing brochures, speaking to parents groups, and submitting information to the media emphasizing the importance of this issue. However, a second component, in addition to education, needs to be an enhanced child restraint law. For this component, we need your help and your vote. Before I close, I'd like to dispel some misunderstandings about this legislation. First, this is not a parental rights issue. This legislation provides parents options from which to choose by not specifying booster seats. We leave a broad definition, appropriate child passenger restraint system. They can choose what's appropriate for their child and their vehicle. Again, all we're doing is asking you to update the information that was put into statute 26 years ago. Second, this is a non-punitive piece of legislation. If you'll notice, the first offense, the fine can be waived if it's shown to law enforcement that within 14 days you've acquired an appropriate child restraint system. Third, this is not a fundraising mechanism for the state of Minnesota. Less than $25,000 was raised across the entire state of Minnesota last year. The average county had perhaps one or two citations. The money that is collected, though, goes into the Minnesota Child Restraint and Education account, and that money is used to provide car seats and booster seats to low-income families, so it's not a financial strain. But I would like to emphasize that current law mandates the car seat through age three. That's the expensive piece of equipment. That's the seat that can cost $50, $60, $100 if you go to the really high end. What we're talking about is if a parent chooses a booster seat, we're talking about a $12 purchase at Target. So something that certainly is not a strain on virtually anyone's personal finances. And again, this account has been established by the Department of Public Safety to help those that may have low-income needs. So I urge you on behalf of our membership to vote in favor of this legislation. We're asking you to update a piece of legislation that's been out of date for almost 26 years. I thank you and your time, you and your committee for the time you've given us, for the support you've given us in past years. Again, we're hoping this committee will pass the legislation as it's done in the past. The Senate will pass it off the Senate floor as it's done in the past. And we hope this year to bridge the gap with the House. What I'd like to do is introduce you now to the mother of Bryn Duncan, Dixie Duncan, again, a constituent of Senator Langsess, referenced in the guest editorial that I've provided to you. She will be followed by Dr. Karagu from HCMC and Officer O'Neill from the Lakeville Police Department. At that point, Senator Carlson and I can answer any questions that you might have. Thank you.
Ms. Duncan, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Dixie Duncan, and I'm the mother of Bryn. I'm here also to be the voice for Bryn. We felt this law was important for Bryn, so important that we wanted the family here. My husband is here, Cody, as well as two of Bryn's sisters. We've also brought some photos of Bryn so you can see what it is and get to know her better as well. Our hope for Bryn and the family and our prayer is that you will hear her story. That we vow that no other child has to go through what Bryn has had to go through and endure this last fall when from a car accident that happened in August of 18. Bryn has been is a spunky, tenacious 8-year-old. She has never walked. She ran, skipped, jumped wherever she went. Like most kids her age, Bryn loved sports and played with friends. However, on August 18th was when her life changed instantly. In a last-minute shopping spree with her grandma, Bryn was not in a booster seat when the transition was made into her grandma's car. She was not restrained by the booster seat, but by a regular restrained adult restraining, which she then put behind her neck, behind her back, when they were traveling. Because the adult seat belt did not fit properly, the lap portion rode up above her lap and onto her stomach. Bryn had then put the other piece behind her and was way too big for her body. The vehicle she was riding in was involved in a crash in Fergus Falls, Minnesota. According to the paramedics who were first on the scene, Bryn was found unconscious with her head between her knees. The impact caused Bryn's upper body to fly forward violently, and Dr. Karaga will explain her injuries from that. We want to share the injuries that have impacted Bryn since August. We watched Bryn endure endless procedures, severe surgeries, and a great deal of pain. It was a roller coaster of emotions for our family. During this time, we experienced with Bryn great depression, where she would not even talk to us for times, had wished that she was dead. After a time of great depression, tears, the spunk started to come back in Bryn's eyes, and she was able to sit up, learn how to dress herself, transfer into her wheelchair. Bryn came back to us, but her ability to feel and move her legs did not. She will be paralyzed for the rest of her life. She spent another month in rehabilitation, and we are now back at home in Moorhead, where she is also now attending school. However, she still requires around-the-clock cares to be sure that her bowel and bladder are functioning correctly. I often get up a couple of times in the evenings also to attend to her needs. We are unable to stay in our current home because it is too small, and Bryn was not even able to get into the bathroom to use it to brush her teeth. The whole town of Moorhead has surrounded around us, and due to fundraisers and others, Bryn, from the kindness of the community, they are building us a new home at this time. A recent AAA study found that the majority of the parents rely on their state legislation to guide them on how to restrain their child in the vehicle. When I was asked to help promote this law, the booster seat, it was something that we as a family wanted to make sure that we were behind this because we knew Bryn's injuries would not be this extent had she been in that booster seat. However, on the day of the crash, because of the quick shift of plans and the transfer of Bryn into Grandma's truck, the booster seat was not present. Had it been state law, Bryn would have never gone without it. We would have automatically had that booster seat in Grandma's vehicle at all times because Grandma is a vital part of our life and the kids are often with her. State law requires Bryn to be buckled, is what saved her life, but the booster seat would have saved her from a spinal cord injury as well as the extensive internal injuries that she has suffered. We have agreed to have our story told so that no other child will have to suffer through the injuries she has experienced. She is once again a spunky and tenacious child who loves sports and has had a great deal finding new ways to participate in the different activities. But there are long days and hard days that we have ahead of us. As we moved out of our old house, Bryn was quick to say, "The reason we have to move is because of me." There are days where we cry as Bryn has come home from school saying it's hard to watch her friends run in class that she doesn't run with anymore. But together with our faith and love and support of our community, Bryn will still thrive. I have heard the arguments against this law. Some parents don't like the law and tell them how to and they don't want the laws to tell them how to transport their children. Others think having the booster seat until your child is at least 8 years old would be a hassle. They cannot imagine having to get their child in or out of one by spending $15. We as Bryn's family say boost your child for Bryn. It is a small hassle, but the safety they provide in many ways at any time for the money that is being used. Bryn is now 8 and still rides in a booster seat as she is still very underweight. Please pass this law to help children in the state of Minnesota to be safe. Pass this law for Bryn.
Thank you, Ms. Duncan. I realize that providing testimony here today is difficult for you and your family, and we sure appreciate you coming and sharing your personal story. It always adds to the discussion when we have people who have been whose families have been impacted by the business that we do here on a daily basis. And so we really appreciate it. Thank you very much. Senator Carlson, if you'd like to have Dr. Kirigou. Is it Kirigou? Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the Senate Committee on Transportation for affording me this opportunity to testify before you about the importance of the legislation regarding booster seat use for children ages 4 to 8. My name is Andrew Kirigou, and I'm the medical director of the Pediatric Intensive Care Unit at Hennepin County Medical Center. I also serve on the board of the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. In addition to my duties as an ICU physician at Hennepin, I serve as the principal investigator of the Injury-Free Coalition for Kids of Minneapolis, which is part of a national organization that was founded to research injury prevention methods. As a pediatric intensive care physician, I have the daily privilege of taking care of children that are critically injured or critically ill. Unfortunately, given the nature of the work I do, I see a fair amount of suffering experienced by the most vulnerable of those amongst us, our children. Death and devastating life-changing disability are some of the saddest things that I have to deal with. I'm personally most saddened when the injuries could have been easily prevented. I want to acknowledge Bryn Duncan, her mother Dixie, and the rest of her family. And I want to thank them for allowing me to share some images from her car crash and to share her story. I was one of Bryn's physicians for the nearly 2 months that she was at Hennepin County Medical Center, from around mid-August till early October of last year. She and her grandmother were involved in a motor vehicle crash, and she, as you can see, sustained horrific injuries that have changed her life forever. She was not riding in a booster seat, and although she was wearing a seatbelt, she had placed the shoulder portion behind her, which kids often do when they are too short for their adult seatbelt because it runs across their neck, and so it's very uncomfortable. So a lot of kids will put it behind them. Because the shoulder portion of her seatbelt was not in place, she sustained a severe type of what we call a lap belt injury, or what people refer to as seatbelt syndrome. Her spinal cord was permanently, in effect, severed at the waist. Because the lap portion of the belt was not low on her hips, her internal organs were also injured, including a transected small bowel, a lacerated liver, and a shattered kidney. She also sustained a brain concussion, multiple rib fractures, and pulmonary contusions or bruises of her lungs. I'm going to show a couple of slides that may illustrate the severity of the injury. This is the, I don't know if you're able to see properly, but this is the front and this is her back. She's lying on some materials here. But if you look over here, you can see her spine, which is supposed to follow a natural contour. But at the level of the first lumbar vertebrae, you can notice it doesn't follow the normal contour. This is her spinal cord, which should look the same all the way down, but right at that point, you also notice that there is an abnormality. This picture gives a better illustration of the injury at the first lumbar fracture, lumbar vertebrae. You can see this is all supposed to be coming down and following this nice curve, but it's jutting out. We call this a chance fracture, which is a fractured dislocation, which occurred at the first lumbar vertebra. This is a picture following the surgery that she had done, and you can see metal rods that are in place. And another diagram that kind of illustrates the large screws that have had to be placed in there to stabilize her spine. An illustration of her when she was still on the breathing machines in the hospital, showing an endotracheal tube, a big line that goes into the vessels that take blood to the heart. Again, the hardware. Because of the injuries to her small bowel, She had to have a number of tubes placed. She was actually not able to eat. By the time she left our facility, she was only able to take small amounts, but had to be fed by tube. And you can see really all these tubes that are in her. And this is a picture kind of illustrating what those tubes looked like. So Bryn underwent multiple surgeries, and she was taken care of physicians in Fergus Falls, and then she went to Fargo, North Dakota, where because she was very unstable, she had emergency surgery to repair her small bowel injury. And then because of her significant neurologic injury, she was brought to Hennepin County Medical Center. Because of the severity of the injuries to her organs, Bryn's right kidney and gallbladder were removed. She also had her appendix removed. Over the course of her hospitalization, as Bryn's mom has alluded to, she suffered immense pain, long periods of depression, also suffered multiple fevers and infections. As I alluded to, by the time she left, she was only taking minimal amounts of by mouth and was being fed through a tube in her small bowel. Unfortunately, when she did try to eat, the pain was often unbearable, and many times she was unable to keep anything down. However, and thankfully, she was able to get better and was able to get well enough to go to inpatient rehabilitation and eventually home to her family. I hope that you will get a chance to meet this beautiful little girl and her wonderful family. Based upon the significant amount of research that has been done throughout the country and my personal experience in caring for patients that have suffered injury caused by an improperly placed seatbelt, it is clear that a child cannot safely use an adult seatbelt alone until they are at least a minimum of 4 feet 9 inches tall. Many children may reach that height by age 8, and so that is the law in the majority of other states. It is my medical opinion that this law should cover children at least until they reach age 8. We should also be educating children and their families during these booster years that they need to use the type of restraint that will give them the most protection, even beyond age 8 if necessary. The case for securing a child properly in a motor vehicle is compelling. Car safety seats reduce the risk of death by 71% for infants and 54% for children ages 1 to 4 as compared to unrestrained children. Car safety seats reduce the risk of death for children ages 2 to 6 by 28% as compared to the use of seat belts alone. 48% of children between the ages of 4 and 8 who were killed in motor vehicle crashes were unrestrained. Using a booster seat with a seat belt instead of just a safety belt reduces a child's risk of injury by 59%. Clearly, car safety seat and booster seat use save lives. I hope that I never have to treat another child with the injuries that Bryn experienced. As a physician, my goal is to restore a child to their pre-injury quality of life. Sadly, my colleagues and I cannot always do this when it comes to treating brain and spinal cord injuries, often associated with smaller children using adult seat belts. The only cure for these types of injuries is prevention. And the best prevention tool that we have in the age group of between 4 and 8 is a booster seat. I just wanted to show a diagram that might explain partly why this happens. If a child is in a booster seat, the lap belt goes over the bony portions of her hip, of the hips, which is protective. With using an adult seat belt, it just goes over the abdomen where it can cause a lot of injury. As Gail has alluded to before, and this is an old slide, actually, as of January this year, Minnesota is only one of six states does not have such a law in place. Dear Senators, you have an opportunity to make a difference in the lives of Minnesota's children. Help pass this bill into law, and hopefully because of that, you will effectively have reduced the likelihood that another child will suffer as Bryn and her family have. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. I believe that Officer O'Neill.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for having me here today. My name is Officer Kevin O'Neill. I'm a police officer with the City of Lakeville Police Department, representing the law enforcement community today. I've worked in law enforcement since 1993, starting my career in the state of Florida, and I've been proud to serve with the City of Lakeville Police Department since 2001. Many of my duties as a police officer have revolved around specialized assignments in traffic safety and community programs, including child passenger safety. I'm a certified child passenger safety technician, and I've participated in numerous car seat safety clinics and also assisted in teaching with the CPS curriculum for new technicians. I'm a member of Minnesota's Child Passenger Safety Board, and I was also honored this past fall to have been an invited speaker and trainer at the University of Minnesota's Towards Zero Death Traffic Safety Conference. As a police officer and parent of four elementary school-age children, my experiences with child passenger safety have both been personal as well as professional. Professionally, I do spend a considerable amount of time helping members of our community with car seat checkups, child safety seat clinics. I also speak to parent groups, daycares, and schools on the topic of child passenger safety. Through these contacts with parents and caregivers, I've learned that our state statute is oftentimes out of date and not in the best interest of our children. When I explain the best practices regarding booster seats to parents, many will simply ask me, what does the law say? And since our present law does not address booster seats, I would frequently have to respond with a comment about the law of physics as opposed to any law that might earn you a traffic citation. As you can see, updating Minnesota's law is not a means for police to issue more citations, but rather an opportunity to make more parents and caregivers aware of the proper and safest way to restrain children in a motor vehicle. As with almost every traffic law, law enforcement officers always have the discretion in most enforcement situations. This bill is not an attempt to criminalize parents. It's simply a means to make children safer in cars when parents sometimes don't understand the dynamics that could be present in a crash. And in the event that a driver is actually issued a citation for this offense, there's still the option for that person to have the ticket dismissed if they were to obtain a proper safety or booster seat within 14 days of the ticket being issued. The driver can then bring the proof of purchase that they obtained for the seat and bring their copy of the ticket with them to the police station. The ticket will be dismissed. There's no fine, no record of the citation on their driving license record. It's handled like any other fix-it ticket that you may be familiar with for things like broken windshields or burnout headlights. In addition, any enforcement of this addition to the child restraint law would be handled just as the present law is. The present statute has a specific age requirement, but has always been handled by a common sense approach for officers to simply ask parents for any needed information. Parents would not need to worry about carrying birth certificates to prove age or tape measures to show heights. Education and awareness is just as important as enforcement when it comes to the stated goal of traffic safety. A clear and appropriate statute can help accomplish all of these goals. However, as a father, I also have the opportunity to compare notes with friends, family, and other parents. And in these conversations, I found that many can find the rules, recommendations, and laws regarding what is safest for our children to be confusing and incomplete. I've realized that many of the parents believe that if Minnesota's child restraint law was unsafe, it certainly would be changed to reflect the best practices. Using my own family as an example, we're the kind of people that this bill would strive to reach and guide. I've got four children, one boy and three girls, all aged 10 and under. And as parents, we try in so many ways to keep our kids safe. Like others, we read up on the safety of toys and recall of children's products. We research which cars have the best crash test ratings. We drive vehicles with anti-lock brakes and stability control. And when we're shopping, we look to see which models on the car lot have the 5-star crash test ratings. For many parents like us, we would only naturally look to our state law for guidance on what's safest to buckle up our kids ages 4 to 8 years old. However, as the statute presently reads, there's no mention or requirement of booster seats. Now, in addition, I personally understand the convenience, or maybe inconvenience, of having to carry extra booster seats when carpooling to events. However, I've often thought that none of us have ever had children as a way of making our lives more convenient. The cost of backless booster seats is a mere $12 to $18, and that's a very small price to pay towards the safety of our children. In a recent traffic crash that I investigated in Lakeville, I was faced with an injured child and the misuse of a safety seat that contributed to the injuries. During the investigation, the mother of the injured child commented repeatedly that she was unsure and confused about exactly what was the best or safest way to buckle up her child. In so many cases, parents will look to the law as a guide on what is best, safest, or most appropriate. By passing this bill, much of the same experience or much of the same confusion experienced by other Minnesota parents can be eliminated. As Minnesota's elected officials, you have the opportunity to follow the example of 44 other states and strengthen our state's child restraint law. In law enforcement, we hope that you will capitalize on this so that we don't have to walk up to the scene of a crash and see a child killed or severely injured unnecessarily because they were not properly restrained. Car crashes kill more children between the ages of 4 and 8 than anything else. Seatbelts save lives, but a seatbelt that doesn't properly fit will not protect a child in a crash. Booster seats solve this problem. Thank you.
thank you, Officer O'Neill. And I suppose if you've got four kids and you've got a lot of experience in swapping booster seats back and
yes,
forth,
sir.
And and you work in the program, have you ever had any problems in acquiring a booster seat for, say, a family in need?
No, sir. We have them actually at the police department that we can hand out to people who are in need and maybe wouldn't be able to afford it otherwise.
Now, that's been a big sticking point for this bill, not here in the Senate. The Senate has traditionally passed this bill along with several other safety measures traditionally. But I think when you go to the other body, I hope that you come and provide some testimony for the House members so that they understand that this is not a financial hardship on folks. Maybe just explain how your program works. And I know as soon as my son gets or grandson gets old enough, my two sons are well over 6'5", I think. But my grandson, as soon as he gets old enough, I'm just going to gather up all the booster seats and take them down and give them to our sheriff because they do the same thing. So maybe you can explain to the folks how that works in your department.
Yes, sir.
Great.
Thank you.
So,
Mr. Chair and committee members.
Senator Carlson.
I think you've heard a lot of statistics here, but let's repeat maybe two of the most important ones, that having proper child restraints reduces the chances of injury 59%, and that there's a 28% reduction in the chance of death. And as the officer said, what does the law say? And I have a few samples here of owner's manuals. My van, my Camaro, and a newer car, one of the legislative assistants. This is a Mazda RX-8, which is a sports car. Every one of them has similar language in it. And I might be able to read just one paragraph here. It says, whatever child restraint system you consider, please pick the appropriate one for the age and size of the child. Obey the law. follow the instructions that come with the individual child restraint system. That's continuous in all of the owner's manuals that I looked at. And what that means is that the parents are looking at this and they're looking for the law to guide them, just like the officer said. What does the law say? Well, our law doesn't say anything. Just says that they need to have a seatbelt above age 4. So what we need to do here is we need to provide that guidance. We need to provide a way to educate parents. This is not something that parents are always aware of. I wasn't always aware of everything when my children were that age. Right now, they are the age of parents. So this is something that we need to be sure that we protect the young people that are in our charge. Now, I have one additional testifier that is not on the list, and I'm just going to say a little bit here. This is a little bit of a surprise. I got an email as I was sitting here, and it said, "I am writing to you as a grandmother to Bryn Duncan, a little 8-year-old who is today in a wheelchair due to a car accident nearly 6 months ago. As a grandma who spent too many days and nights in a pediatric intensive care unit, watching not just my own grandchild, but several other children suffering brain and spinal cord injury from car accidents, I cannot begin to explain the anguish and heartbreak of watching a child suffer in such a horrible manner." Now, this came from grandmother Joanne Strom from Sandpoint, Idaho. She obviously couldn't make it here today. So thank you to Grandmother Joanne. Mr. Chair, we will take any questions that the committee has.
Any questions for Senator Carlson or his testifiers? Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, and this isn't a question but just a comment, I too just wanted to echo Chair Murphy's thank you to Bryn and to her mom for testifying and your bravery. So thank you very much.
Senator Carlson, before I let you make a motion, Mr. Jordahl is here, and not to testify today, but there are a couple issues with some of the federal funding that is attached to this, and I think that this bill is going to go to finance, where we'll deal with that end of the bill. But I think between now and then, you and Mr. Jordahl need to get together with Ms. Berzovsky and kind of figure out the path of least resistance. Ms. Weinholzer?
In regards to the federal funding, it would require that we eliminate the exemption of vehicles for hire. We made a conscious decision not to approach that issue, as I'm sure Senator Jungbauer recalls in last year's conference committee. The elimination of the exemption of for-hire vehicles caused a great amount of angst, especially amongst the House, and as they are the tougher body to pass this legislation, we made a conscious decision not to approach the for-hire vehicles, not to eliminate the exemption. And quite frankly, the money that was made available through NHTSA has dwindled through the years, and we felt it better to pass the legislation without making that exemption.
And we will be visiting that situation again. I feel very strongly that it doesn't matter what vehicle it is, whether it's a taxi cab or your personal vehicle or the airport shuttle. Appropriate is appropriate, inappropriate is inappropriate. And that's why I want you all to have a discussion with Mr. Jordahl. Evidently, there's some other language that needs to happen as far as a definition for clarification. Senator Scoy.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And could how much money is the potential loss?
Ms. Weinholzer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy. Potentially, it would be approximately $140,000 that would be made available to the state and the Department of Public Safety for educational purposes and low-income families. That's again,
great.
Our concern is passing the House.
Yes. And we're with you on that.
So,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Carlson.
In the past, the past bill that we had last year, that number was in the $300,000 range. So it has, as Ms. Weinholder said, it has dwindled substantially.
Yeah. You know, most of the time these federal dollars are put out, and it's kind of first come, first serve. And if you're last to be served, you don't get anything. And anybody that's from a large family knows that all too well. So, and we're a family of 50. So, Senator Carlson, if you'd like to make your motion now, I think the committee's ready to vote. Ma'am.
I would like to address the committee, please.
Oh, yes, ma'am, please.
I am Bryn's
Here,
other
please.
Grandma. I was the lady driving the car.
Ma'am, can you state your name for the record, please?
My name is Linda Duncan.
Ms. Duncan, please.
I am Bryn's grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard to come forward. It was very emotional. I was the lady driving the car. So it's horrendous, horrendous guilt that a grandparent or a parent should feel. And I can deal with it. It's very difficult days and nights to just cry and cry. But what I want to say is that we learn from experience, preferably someone else's experience. Unfortunately, this was my experience and Brim's. But you can all learn from it by seeing that this gets taken care of and voted through, not just here, but forward. She has suffered greatly. And the pain and emotional suffering, the heartache for the family and extended family is horrendous. And it has gotten better, but it's never going to get great. It's not going to maybe get real good. We have to live with this the rest of our lives. And what I am trying to say is, probably the two saddest words that we ever say is, if only. And just don't let other people have to say, if only. Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Duncan. Senator Saltzman.
Yes. I just want to thank you, Mrs. Duncan. I can only imagine how difficult this is for you, but I think you made such an important point, and that is what we learn. And I want to thank you for your courage, as Senator Bonoff talked about, to your daughter-in-law, and also to Bryn. You have a family that loves you so much, and you are one lucky girl for that, to have a family who cares about you and is going to make sure that something that happened to you doesn't have to happen to other kids because someone thought, you know, I didn't realize how important this is. And that's why, to Senator Murphy, you have led all of us in making sure that safety is something that we never forget. And we talk a lot about roads and bridges and tolls in this committee, but we have a very important role in how safe people are when they're on our roads. And I can't thank you enough for being here, Mrs. Duncan, to share your story. And I will be behind you as is carried forward to the other body.
Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair and committee, I would like to move Senate File 99 to pass and to be forwarded to the
Finance
Committee.
On the Carlson motion that Senate File 99 be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Finance, is there anybody who wants to testify in opposition to the bill? On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Let the record reflect that it was unanimous voice vote. The motion does prevail. Thank you, Senator Carlson, and thank you, Doctor, and to the Duncan family and Officer O'Neill. Thank you very much, and the committee is now adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rod.